This particular story begins in the dusky hollows of 1991, remembered as a rotten year through and through by everyone. I'm sure there were a few who had it good, but for the rest of us, there wasn't a glimmer. January dawned with tracers over Baghdad, the Gulf War. In America, we slopped along in recession, and meanwhile, I wasn't feeling so good myself. That year, I was to graduate from a creative writing program for fiction in Ann Arbor, Michigan, aka Storytelling School. I was 26 years old and making about $5,000 a year, pre-tax, sharing an apartment with another writing student. It began to dawn on us that the end of our cosseted academic ride was near. We were hours away from the cruelest epiphany, those preciously imagined short story collections and novels qualified us for, well, almost exactly nothing. Which is what led me to a local deli, a place called Zingerman's, to see if they needed an extra sandwich maker. It was a legend, a fabled arcade of fantastic food with a tin ceiling, black and white tiled floor, and the yummiest delicacies from around the world. In the days before the rise of gourmand culture, Zingerman's preached a new way of thinking about food: eat the best and eat homemade. So one June day found me hiking up the steep stairs to the office above the deli and presenting myself as the answer to their problems, whatever their problems were. Within 3 minutes, two of them spent waiting. One of the deli mistresses set me straight. "We don't have anything right now," she said, as 7 phones rang at once, and she turned back to business. A few days later, the same woman called me back. "I notice you've done some proofreading," she said, her eyes skimming my resume. "Ari writes all the customer newsletters himself, and we could use someone to check it each month." "Done," I said. The newsletter sat in stacks in the store. It was part foodie Bible, part travelogue. During a time when microwave popcorn passed for dinner, the subject of fine food offered me a vicarious thrill. I took on my task with enthusiasm. Ari's passion was unbridled, infectious. Fresh from a trip to Spain, his latest opus was about olives and wine and Salamanca and ham. I padded an entry about sherry and lightened another about olive oil. I turned the page, and suddenly, from nowhere, came a perfect entry. It was about a special cheese Ari had hunted down, and it appeared under the headline, "New and Amazing." "This is really an outstanding piece of cheese," Ari wrote. "So anonymous, I discovered it by chance. It's also the most expensive cheese we've ever sold. Makes me a little nervous just putting it on the counter." He went on to describe how he had visited Castile and met the cheesemaker himself, who was keeping a family tradition alive. When asked by Ari how he justified making such expensive cheese, the man had said, "Because it is made with love." "It's rich, dense, intense," sang Ari. "There was something about all of it, the prose, the story," he told, "that I couldn't stop thinking about. It occurred to me that there we were, living through cursed 1991, in a crushing recession, and along came this outrageous, presumptuous little cheese, fabulous in character, made by an incorruptible artiste who said its high price tag, $22 per pound, came because it was made with love. That cheese, which I couldn't even afford to taste, had traveled so far to be here. Its brash lack of cynicism in a rotten year gave me a strange kind of hope. I felt that this cheese would speak to me. But in the rush of my own life, the cheese faded for a while, until it asserted itself once again with an exclamation point. After storytelling school, I eventually became a journalist. I published a book, interviewed the great and the not so good, met Bill Clinton, went to Cuba, where in one of the stranger moments of my young life, I found myself embraced and lifted off the ground by Fidel Castro, who smelt like soap. I paid taxes, got married to Sarah, another writer, and just days after the new millennium, we had a child. Our baby's name was Leo. His arrival inspired me to new levels of action. I began cleaning the garage and the back porch, and then I started on everything else, emptying closets and drawers in a frenzy of fatherly cleanliness. I discarded old files from every epoch, and then I came upon a folder labeled Stuff, with the now yellowed shred of that old newsletter about an expensive cheese called Páramo de Guzmán. At this time, I was making plans to go to Spain to interview an iconoclastic Spanish chef for a magazine story. I called upon my friend Carlos, a high school Spanish teacher who lived down the street, convincing him to ring the one listed number in Guzmán to ask about the man who made the cheese. It was the town bar. He was given another number. Carlos dialed again. A woman answered. Carlos explained that we were looking for a man who made cheese. Then, after a long hesitation, she said we had called the wrong number. The cheese isn't made by my husband anymore. Carlos asked for his name. Ambrosio, she said. The name beamed up, bounced off a satellite, and fell back to our ears. Ambrosio, the maker of the divine cheese. On to Spain it was, to visit the Catalan chef and to find this Ambrosio. I beseeched Carlos to join me, and he became my Sancho Panza. The chef was a short man called Ferran Adrià, with frantic hair and quick, thin lips. He was a voyager in the kitchen, exploring faraway planets of science and food. He said things like, "There's more emotion in a piece of ruby-red grapefruit with a little sprinkle of salt on it than in a big piece of fish." It was exhausting trying to keep up with his fantastical ideas. Once free of this task, Carlos and I flew to Madrid and drove out of the city to find a landscape that appeared like Mars, its red, lifeless dirt stretching to the horizon. Castile in August had a heat greater than that of tanning beds and Finnish saunas or equatorial sands. It was so hot that car tires actually melted onto the road. The village of Guzmán might as well not have existed. There were no signs for it. So we started asking directions 7 times. We rode a swerving incline through brown vineyards, barley fields, and sunflowers, hundreds of them, heads tilted like so many furry satellite dishes to the mother source. When we finally found the village, we chatted amiably with a handful of locals, old men sitting under trees drinking red wine, which they shared with us. They drank from a device called a purón, of Catalan origin. It had been co-opted long ago by the rest of the country for communal drinking, the perfect reliquary for that most holy of Spanish libations, wine. According to the unwritten rules of the land, it was an egregious violation of etiquette to suck on the spout with your mouth. Rather, you held the purón aloft and sent the wine arcing down your open gullet. It was an art form, really. When the purón came to me, I made the fatal mistake of all first-timers. I tilted it tentatively, which created a lack of downward pressure, and a limp rivulet flowed through the glass nozzle, missing my lower lip, but leaving a jagged red line down the front of my shirt as if I'd been shot. When everyone laughed, I knew that we had indeed arrived. We told our new friends that we had come to eat the cheese of a man named Ambrosio. "There," said one of the men, pointing to a cave in the hillside with thick, weathered wooden doors. "There is the bodega of Ambrosio." I hesitated before knocking. Though I'd had months to imagine this meeting, it crossed my mind that it would have been nice to prepare an opening statement of some sort, which is when the door suddenly swung open before us. "Venga," said a booming voice. "Come in." This was the cheesemaker. A bulky form filled the doorframe, and he moved back to make way for us. We climbed some steps into a small room, our eyes adjusting to the gloom. He offered us a purón. I tilted it back tentatively, and a rivulet flowed down, missing my lip and drizzling more wine down my shirt. We chatted amiably for a while over the wine and a plate of chorizo. He inquired about our travels. Then, while he expertly sucked the equivalent of a glass of wine from the purón, I explained how I had come to hear of his cheese. I pulled a tape recorder from my pocket and asked if I could record our conversation. Though I hadn't a clue what he said at first, his voice echoed in that cramped room like shockwaves. I'd expected him to be much older, had envisioned him in his own BlackBerry, maybe even with a cane, small and humped and slightly deaf. But here he was, a strapping specimen of Castilian man. In his mid-40s, he had a Falstaffian belly with a full head of hair, mournful, close-set eyes, and a prominent nose, the full effect of which left the impression of a surprising handsomeness. He dressed in dusty work boots, and the cuffs of his pants were dirty too. But he also sported an elegant monogrammed shirt with thin navy pinstripes. He began to talk about the cave. This region of Castile, we learned, is littered with bodegas, handmade caves dating back to a time long before refrigeration. They'd been used for storing the fruits of the harvest for centuries. Legend had it that a man would sit in a room above the cave and itemize what went down into the cellars. This room became known as El Contador, or the counting room. Soon, people began to gather there to share meals, drink wine, and pass the time in the cool darkness. As the centuries unfolded, the caves came to serve a more social purpose, and the room took on the other definition of contar, to tell. The contador then became a telling room, where stories were told. It was here where the young Ambrosio first fell under the trance of his father telling stories. He would listen for hours in a state of mesmerized joy. He possessed no interest in school, and over time, he would become a farmer like his father. He and his best friend, Julian, a tall kid with gangly legs and big knees, went everywhere together. Ambrosio was the ringleader. Julian became his happy conspirator. And when they grew up, they were each there when the other met his future wife. Their devotion to each other was unwavering. "But can he tell us the story of his cheese?" I asked Carlos to ask Ambrosio. When this was translated, we watched his face transform with the difficulty of what he had to say next. He looked up with pursed lips and sad eyes. For a handsome man, his face somehow contained both a life of hard-lived mirth and strange tragedy. We, these strangers from across the ocean, leaned in, listening intently. At last, the story burst forth. Over the next 8 hours, through the evening and into the early morning, with a pause only for dinner, by the time it was over, I, too, wanted revenge. He started by setting the scene, by describing how a midlife illness suffered by his father saw him make a pact with God that he would trade his own life for his father's, which was not necessary as his father made a good recovery. He felt for years that he owed something to the universe. He waited. Then, one fine summer evening, out in the fields, he and his father missed their merienda, the late day snack before dinner. They were starving, talking about food. Ambrosio's father craved some wine, which was typical, and he added some cheese would be fine. At that moment, the idea to make the perfect cheese entered Ambrosio's mind, fully formed. He had a memory of eating his family's cheese as a child, and even now could conjure its sharp tang and the images of his mother's kitchen with its gas fires and simmering pots of milk. As he understood it, the family cheese had been made for so long, there'd never been a written recipe. Standing in that field with his hungry father, Ambrosio Molinos had a revelation. Why? Why had they stopped? Why couldn't they make it again? He had no clue how to do it, but in his great, impractical brain, there were no what-ifs or let's-sees, just that Iberian blast of confidence that set Spanish galleons sailing to the New World. We will do it.